All right, and please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Athena from the Underground Group in Philadelphia.
Hi, everybody. My name's Athena, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Athena.
Hi, guys. So, Athena, alcoholic. I have a sobriety date, April 19th, 2009. I have a sponsor. She's awesome. I get to sponsor others. I have a home group. It's the Underground. Also a super cool group. Tuesdays, Thursdays, 8 o'clock, 4th and Lombard, Philadelphia. Come visit. We have cheesesteaks and pizza. Eat a lot of Thai food afterwards. So, it never fails. Like, how many times I do this, I still get really nervous. And then I come up here and I forget what I'm supposed to do. It's like very simple. Like, I used to want to die all the time, right? I used to almost die all the time because of alcoholism kicking my ass. And that's no longer the case. So I just have a really simple job today. I try to be good about the time. Thank you. So I'll start from the beginning. So I come from two very normal people. They just celebrated their 34th wedding anniversary. I posted pictures on Facebook. They're really amazing people. And I say normal because, like, they met when my mom was 15 and my dad was 17, I think. And then they got married at, like, 19. And then they had a baby. And then they had no money, right? And then my dad joined the Army without telling my mom. But that was because he didn't want us growing up in the Bronx. And so I say normal because he was like, hey, I have this problem. I have, you know, this wife and this child and no money. And we don't want to live in the Bronx anymore, so I'm just going to join the military and I'm going to be a responsible adult. And this was at, like, 21. Like, I could not fathom having a family and then, like, being responsible, right? And at any age, probably. Like, I couldn't, like, the idea of responsibility just didn't, it has a very different meaning now than before I got sober. So I was a military brat and I moved around to different, like, states. I lived in Germany for a little bit. And you know, when people ask, like, oh, you got to live in Hawaii, how was that? It's like my standard answer was like, oh, that's really cool. But I hated it because I was just so awkward. Like, I was like this creepy little weird girl, right? And I'd show up to school and I would expect, like, a parade or something, like, new girl, we love you. And that would never happen. And so I would just be like this little, like, weirdo walking in, expecting a whole bunch of friends and then not understanding, like, why that wasn't happening. And so I was just like a lonely little thing. And I was just full of fear at, like, a young age. My mom talks about how when I was 6 and the next door neighbor girls didn't invite me to their party, like, how upset I got. And she's like, I am this grown woman and I got a resentment against these girls because of you were so, like, emotional about it, right? And I think maybe at 6, that's okay, I guess, because I never grew out of that. Like, that was sort of my reaction to life, was like resentment, fear, anxiety all the time. And again, my normal parents did not drink. I mean, they drank, but again, very normally, you know? My dad would get drunk with his military buddies, and they would, like, do fake commercials about drugs, which was really funny. And then they would, you know, then they would go do Army stuff the next day. They would go back to work. They would wake up and do PT at O-Dark 30. And my mom was, like, raising me, right? So, also, they came from, like, those were the normal, my parents were the normal people. They came from alcoholic households, right? So definitely my mom's side, so my grandfather, my dad's side, his father. So if anybody was going to be an alcoholic by circumstance, it should have been my parents. But I learned later, alcoholism is not a circumstantial thing. So they didn't drink too much. And then my first drink was when I was 13. And I remember my view of how drinking was going to, it was very romantic because I based reality off of TV. So I was like, it's very sexy, right? So I'm like, it's going to be real sexy. So I'm going to go ahead and drink a lot of alcohol and it's going to be wonderful. And it was very exciting. Like, even before I put it into my system, I had this idea that something cool was going to happen. And like I said, creepy little weird girl. So I only had, like, a maximum of 2 friends every time I moved somewhere. And so my friend Rachel, for some reason, her dad was okay with 13-year-olds drinking alcohol in his basement. So we are in the basement and we're drinking wine, homemade wine, drinking a whole bunch of wine. And then Rachel's older sister happens to be cool, so she has her friends there. And something happened my very first time drinking where, like, I'm putting alcohol into my system, and at some point in the night, I remember that I told this joke. So I don't know, I was thinking about pirates, a book on my head. I told this joke, and this guy, Nick, he was cool, he laughed. And that was something that was, like, really important to me because I'm so socially awkward, and I'm so nervous, and I'm so... that for me to just kind of like let loose and tell a joke and make these people laugh, it was like, I knew I was hilarious. I just needed to be drunk, right? That's day one of drinking. I logged that sort of, okay, noted. So I didn't like drink every day, but I drank as often as I possibly could, which is, you know, weekends, like going over to friends' houses where their parents don't mind like teenagers drinking. As a parent now, that's so weird. So I drank occasionally, I drank on the weekends, and even from the beginning, I was making other people responsible for me, right? So I would drink too much, and then I would like, I don't know, I'd end up like wandering on a highway or something, and people would have to take care of me. But I was totally, what's the word, I totally inconsiderate, right? So I was completely inconsiderate to the fact that other people had to be responsible for me, even in the very beginning of my drinking. So what happened? So I'm 16, and my dad said, "Hey, what do you want to be when you grow up?" I was like, "I don't know, a pilot." I don't even know where I came up with that. So I started flying planes, and I got my pilot's license in high school, and it was really cool. I loved flying planes. I thought this was really neat. And then I picked the school to go to for college, and I picked this place in Jacksonville, Florida. And the reason why I picked it is because there was this guy there, and we were going to get married. But I told my parents it was because I could fly with Delta, and that was like a really good excuse, right? So I moved down to Florida. I graduated high school. I go down to Florida. I'm flying planes, and I'm going to class whenever I want, and I'm like living in an apartment. And I remember the first time I opened up a big book when Bill talked about how he had arrived. Like, this was my he had arrived moment. I had more than two friends, you know, like I could drink on any day of the week. I was flying planes. I could skip class. I could go to the beach. I was living off of student loans, so I had no concept of money. It was wonderful. And then, as typical with any alcoholic, right, alcohol stopped working. And that's when thing, you know, my, he had a ride moment, that ski slope that Bill talks about, that was my experience after that. So I'm drinking, and then slowly drinking on the weekends and drinking on weeknights became drinking like, if I put vodka in my orange juice, then I'm more comfortable answering questions in class, right? And some of my friends started to look at me a little weird, and they're not alcoholics, and they're kind of like, why are you going to drink and go to class? But it just seemed like, I don't know, it seemed like a normal, rational thing to do, but alcoholism, normal, rational thinking is not really my forte. So what happened? So I'm drinking all the time, and I'm flying planes, and we have this thing called the 48-hour bottle to throttle rule. So you're not supposed to fly planes within 48 hours of drinking. But I was like, they don't really mean that, you know? It's like 24 hours. And then 24 hours was like 8 hours. And then it was like, well, if you put a little something, you know, extra with the drinking, you're a lot more focused, you know? And then my roommate was like, hey, well, no, I told my roommate, I was like, I think, you know, I missed my flight block. And she's like, no, you definitely flew today. And again, I grew up with very normal people, so I recognized, you know, right from wrong. And I was like, bad to fly planes drunk. But then the next thought was, I guess I got to quit flying. Like, there was no, in my brain, maybe I should quit drinking. Like, that thought didn't even, like, register. I was like, well, you know, there's a lot of other jobs. Who needs to fly planes? So I went to my, you know, I told my parents, I came up with this whole story. I went to my career counselor, and then I dropped aviation, and I had like this sense of freedom because I no longer had that 48-hour rule on me, which I wasn't even following to begin with. And I went crazy, right? I was drinking and doing so many other things. And then I was getting really like creepy and kind of paranoid. And I'd go to parties, and then something clicked in my brain that I'm like, I don't need you. I can just steal your alcohol and your frozen pizza and go back to my place. We're good. So then I became very isolated, and people started to worry about me. And then I stopped going to class. Like I was so consumed with myself that I could not walk in front of people because I would always get nervous. Like, at what point do you look up and say hi? You don't want to do it too soon. You don't want to do it too late. So I was like, I'm just not going to leave my room. Clearly, this is not going to work. And it was like the world got crazy. And the worst part was that no matter how much alcohol I put into my system, that thinking didn't go away. And when I first started drinking, that thinking was that problem was solved of like that conscious, like constant anxiety, fear. That went away with alcohol. And so now it was just like drinking to drink. So, you know, I ended up with this overdose. I ended up in this mental ward for a couple days. And I remember when I first got there, I was like, whew. Finally, somebody to tell me what to do, right? I was relieved to be there. You know, they told you when to wake up, what to eat, where to go, like even cigarette breaks, and I was fine with, you know, their limitations. So, you know, they let me out after 3 days, and I was like, but what do I do now? Like, nothing has been solved. What do I do, you know? So I just went back to drinking, of course. My roommates eventually called my parents and said, hey, we don't want to be responsible for her life, and we're not sure how long that's going to be, so maybe you should come get her. And my parents were living in El Paso, Texas at that point, and my dad, miracle father, flew to Jacksonville, Florida, and I don't know how he did it, but in 48 hours, I was like, I had been withdrawn from the semester, my stuff had been, I don't even know where my stuff went. Like, I had a whole apartment of things that suddenly were gone. I don't know. I guess he gave them away, sold them, no clue. And then I was on a plane and I went back to El Paso, Texas. And I thought, okay, you know, it's like a new start. I'm going to go to this new state. I don't know what that means. Maybe I could get it together. What that means, I don't even know. But I was going to get it together. And so I get to El Paso, Texas. I'm not 21 yet. I'm like, maybe I could just take a break from drinking. And I didn't drink for like 2 days and my body was on fire. Like my skin, my brain, everything was just like crazy. And then I quickly discovered that I was in El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico, was like a 10-minute walk from my house, and they don't care how old you are in Mexico. So I used to walk over to Juarez, and Juarez is not a very safe place to go, especially if you're a lady by yourself, very drunk. But I didn't care. I was like, alcohol. Like, they used to have this thing called $8 drink and drown. You just give them $8, and then they just give you all of the alcohol. Like, it was amazing. It was my favorite place ever. And so I just would go there, and then you only needed a quarter to get back into the States, and I would always say, don't lose a quarter, don't lose a quarter. And then somehow I would end up with, like, no quarters, and then I would be, like, panhandling on, like, the border and being like, I am American, can I please have a quarter? And then, it's like, usually some military guys would give me a quarter to let me back into the States. So that was my whole I'm gonna get it together trip, right? And it was just like, it was just pathetic. Like, there was nothing fun or enjoyable about my time there. It was pathetic. I was working at this Pizza Hut, and I was just like a toxic human being. So at one point, we had this, you know, there was something going on in our Pizza Hut specifically, and we had like the regional director come in to assess what was going on. And she interviewed everybody, and at one point she pulled me aside, and she's like, Athena, I've identified the problem. It's you. Because I was just like this horror. I was like this thing that sucked the life and joy and goodness out of everything. And I was like shocked. I was like, you know, I could not believe she was saying this to me. I was like trying to figure out what, you know, vendetta she had against me because she was so evil. So that was El Paso, Texas. And then my parents were moving to Philadelphia. And I had decided to run away from home at 20. And I was sharing this room with this chihuahua, no furniture. So I was just getting into arguments with this chihuahua. And then my parents were like, come to Philadelphia, because they were like, we don't know what's going to happen to you. So, you know, I came back to Philadelphia, still not 21. I'm going to get it together. Everything's going to be fine. And I had a Florida license. And again, I was like without alcohol, without anything. So I had to do whatever I could. And so I was able to mess with the license so that it looked like I was born in a different year. And nobody messed with me. And I was able to buy booze. And of course, I got the job that I was good at, which was bartender. So here, Philadelphia, pathetic life, drinking. I didn't really have any friends. Somehow I had a boyfriend, and I don't really know how because I was a very mean person. And there was nothing like, there was nothing exciting. Like, again, like another part in the big book that so resonated with me was When Bill talked about how, like, you know, the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms for mine endure this agony for 2 more years. So, like, there was definitely a point when I, you know, decided to quit flying because you can't fly drunk. And then, like, maybe 2 more years after that, that it was just like, oh, my God. Like, nobody would have been like, can I trade lives with you? Like, there was nothing attractive or... It was just pitiful. It was like this pitiful thing where it's like waking up trying to make it through the day somehow, but not really wanting to, but not having any other options, you know? And that's like, that's a really, I mean, I don't know. Like, so many people, I think, could go on like that. Like, I don't know why. I call it my God shot moment. Because what happened was I was working as a bartender. I had a boyfriend somehow, and we were going out to eat with his friends, because I had no friends. We were going out to eat with his friends, and I got into a fight with him in my head, right? And I was like, oh my God, you're terrible. And so, like, I left this restaurant, and I was, of course, very, very drunk. I left this restaurant, and then I'm walking down, like, the side of the highway, and then I go to this house, and then I go into the house, and then I try to convince the person there that I live there. And they're like, you do not live here. And then I tried to take a nap. I just wanted to take a nap, and they did not understand. So you know, they called the cops, and I get a ride back to the house. And something about the next morning, because that wasn't even, like, my worst night drinking. That wasn't even close to, like, worst night or worst anything. It was another shitty night where I lost all of my stuff. My boyfriend was mad at me. Like, I hated myself. But something in my brain... It was like the first time it was like, your life drinking is never going to work, you know? And it was like, who said that, you know? Because that's not a thought that comes from me. Like, your life drinking is never going to work. But then minutes after that, I was like, maybe I just stopped drinking until my birthday, which was 2 weeks away. Because the idea of a sober birthday, like, I hadn't had fun on my birthday in forever, but the idea of a sober birthday, right? So I'm like, well, let me go to this AA meeting. And then I go to... this AA meeting. And I didn't realize that at this point, I mean, I was an everyday drinker. I wasn't used to, like, remembering dark, you know, because I was usually blacked out by like 5 o'clock. And so the days just felt so incredibly long. And I went to this meeting and I was shaking and I was like, what if somebody knows me, right? AA meeting. So I go to this meeting and I'm like hysterical crying. And they're like, is this anybody new? I'm like, it's me, you know? And nobody was like shocked. Nobody was scared. Nobody was weirded out. And that's what I love about AA. It's like, bring it in. Bring in your crazy. Bring in your weird. Bring it all. Like, we got you, you know? And then the scariest thing ever was when after the speaker, it was a half hour speaker, they said, okay, we're going to take a 5-minute cigarette break. And I was like, what do I do? Like, what do I do? Like, I still smoke, but I'm like, but the people are going to be looking at me, like, all of this stuff. So I go outside, and I'm like, you know, smoking. And this woman comes up to me, and I'm like, my heart is racing as I see her walking towards me. I was like, is she going to tell me to leave? What's going to happen? And she's like, hi, my name's Diane. And then she just started talking. I don't even know what she said, but something happened in those 5 minutes that, like, I was, like, calm. And she's like, do you want to come to a meeting with me tomorrow? And I don't know, it's like the power of one alcoholic working with another. Literally, it was a 5-minute conversation. But like the language of the heart, I heard her, whatever she said. And I was like, yeah, I do want to go to a meeting with you. So I went to a meeting the next day. And then for some reason, work or something, I didn't go to a meeting for 3 days. And I didn't drink for 3 days. Clearly, I'm not an alcoholic, right? So my then boyfriend, I convinced at the time, I said, let's get a 6-pack. It'll be fun, you know. I'll make us a nice steak dinner. So I went to the bar, I grabbed the 6-pack, I'm in the kitchen, I'm like done with my third, I haven't even started cooking, I was just so happy to be drinking. And I told him, I said, hey babe, I'm just going to grab one of your beers. And that was like the first time in our 4-year relationship he told me no. I knew nothing about the like phenomenon of craving, I knew nothing about once you put it into your system, don't stop it, right? So I just thought he was evil, right? So I was like, how could you? So then I threw like his phone out the window, I threw like my phone out the window, like I'm just throwing everything out the window because like he's ruining my life. And then I go downstairs, I go to the bar next door, and then I just drank until they kick me out, complaining about him. And then I wake up the next morning. I don't know how I got home. I don't know what time it is. I missed work again. He hates me again. And I'm just like, damn, like I was truly convinced we were going to have a nice dinner. Like I was absolutely 1000% convinced it was going to be fine. I just, you know, just a couple beers. I'm like, whatever. But that's not the case with alcoholics, you know? And I did not know that until coming here and working with people who could explain it to me. So I was scared, and I think when you're scared and when you are at that point where it's like you can't imagine life with or without alcohol, that's a good place to be, actually, because I was willing to do something crazy, like go back to an AA meeting, because my thinking is like, you can handle your life, you can manage your life, you can do all of this stuff. But I was so grateful that, like, being scared and out of options, I was like, maybe I should go back to this meeting. So I go back to this meeting. No, I go to a new meeting. I go to a beginner's meeting. And they made me share, I don't know what I said, more crying and just like, oh, you know. And they're not scared of it. They're not weirded out. They're like, welcome, like, welcome. Like, they seem genuinely happy that I'm there. And that is so weird because nobody's happy when I'm showing up to places. So again, this woman in front of me turned around. Hi, I'm Ellen. And she talked to me, no clue what she said, but the next, this is what she said. She said, I'm going to call you tomorrow morning. And I wasn't used to hanging out with people who did what they said they were going to do. So when she called, I was like, what? What is this? And she said, come meet me. I will buy you coffee and take you to a meeting. I was like, this woman is amazing. So we go to this meeting and I don't know. I have like those, that like, weird willingness thing that I never really had before. This amazing, amazing gift of willingness that I'm like, I'm going to keep going here. Even though it's weird, all of you guys, still going to show up. And we started going through the big book. And I remember looking at the steps on the wall. And I was like, I could do like two of those. Because I definitely don't believe in God. That's dumb. And I don't like, I mean, they're all about God, so I can just come to these meetings and see how that goes. And so it happened. So we were just kind of like talking about it, and then I was getting really restless, and I was looking at these things, and I was like, I don't know, but then I kept showing up, and then I was going to this clubhouse, and at this time, I think I was like maybe working 2 days a week, so I was going to like four meetings a day. And I was still like, I don't know. And then this one guy said, hey, Big Book Bill is speaking on Sunday. And the way he said it, it was a controversy. And I loved drama and controversy. So I was like, I will be there. Because I need to hear what this guy's all about. I was like, oh, Big Book Bill's coming. So I was like, yes, excitement. So I went to this meeting, and I'm sitting there, and he just said stuff that maybe people had said before, and I just wasn't interested. I was just, again, just going because it was something to do, and it was just like attention, you know, it's like 30-day coin, look at me. It was just something to do, right? So I was probably only paying attention because I was listening for the juicy bits. And something he said just kind of like, maybe people have said it, but I hadn't heard it before. But he was talking about like clear-cut directions and like a program of action and like simple steps, like series of actions, like things that you do. Like, because I feel like I'd been listening to a lot of people talk, and it was like, it was very message, you know? It was very, like, the benefits of the program, and like, you know, thankful and serenity. But I'm like, but what does that mean? Like, what's the tangibility? How do you get that? So when this guy was talking about clear-cut actions, I was like, sir, what are you saying? So I, like, cornered it after the meeting, and he's like, yeah, you got to go through the steps of the big book. And I know people have said that before, but something about, like, his controversial ass or something. So he had, like, this big book, like, this step meeting. It was, like, guys only in his house, but I, like, kept showing up. He's like, you need a sponsor to, like, take you through the steps. So then he's like, go to this meeting. Some girls would be happy to take you through. So I went to this meeting, and this woman came to me, and she was very, like, her name is Annie. And she was very tall and had like these blue eyes, very piercing. And she was like, hello. She's like, I will help you. I will take you through the steps. And I was very excited about that. So I started going through the steps with her. But a couple things, right? So one, I wasn't being honest about my sobriety date. This guy in a meeting had said that he had relapsed by smoking a blunt over the weekend. And I was so delusional that I was like, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. So I still thought I was sober, even though I was clearly not sober because I was smoking a lot of pot and I was snorting amphetamines. But I thought that I was sober because this was Alcoholics Anonymous. I swear to God. So when he said that he had relapsed, I was like, what? Because if you relapse, then that means that I'm not sober. So I tried to convince him. I was like, are you sure? Like, you know, he's like, okay. So I was lying about my sobriety date. When people were talking about the God stuff, I was like, okay, sure. And then I think that that sort of willingness that I had was diminishing. And the way that I was approaching sponsorship and the way that I was approaching the steps was like, let's get through this so I can get the certificate and move on. So I was like moving. I was like, come on, let's do the fourth and fifth step. Come on, let's do it. So we did the fifth step, and I remember like sitting down and doing the fifth step with her. For some reason, in my head, I was very much convinced it was going to be like a therapy, like a very long therapy session. So when she was saying things like, you know, selfishness and like dishonesty and like, you know, when I was talking about how horrible my parents were, and she's like, well, how did you show up as a daughter? I was like, this is not what I thought it was going to be. So I remember after the fifth step, I was like, I should drink. And so when people say that, like, you know, if you're doing the steps, you're not going to drink, it's like, but I think you still need to have like that open-mindedness, honesty, and willingness. And those are the three things that I clearly didn't have. So I decided that I was going to drink and it was going to be fine and then I was going to come back and start off new. So I convinced this guy to drink with me, and his parents had Everclear in his house. And I remember waking up and being like, why am I in so much pain? And my head hurt so bad. And he's like, yeah, you fell off of a 7-foot wall, like face first into concrete. And he's like, I tried to call the ambulance, but you said it was too expensive. Because it is, okay? And so he's like, you said it was too expensive, so I couldn't call the ambulance. But my side and my head, like everything was on fire. And then I go home, and I tried to say picture frame, and I said toothfish. And my roommate was like, maybe you have brain damage. Let's go get checked out. So we went to the ER, and I'm still not really, like, getting the seriousness of any of this. I'm just like, oh, I want onion rings. I remember arguing with the nurse because, like, she would not let me leave because I needed to go to the diner before it closed. I want onion rings. So I'm in there complaining about this nurse. And then I had broken ribs, and I had, you know, bleeding in my brain. And the doctors were just like, I was just such a pain in the ass. Like, I wasn't, like, they were like, this is serious. Like, you could have died. And I'm just like, onion rings, you know? So, like, yelling at me. And then something, so I'm in the hospital. And again, like, I feel like another gotshot moment because in walks my parents. And I was so just, like, disgusted that they were there because they lived in New York. And we were in Philadelphia. Yeah, so I was here in Philadelphia. They were in New York. And I was like, how did you find out about this, right? And it's like a moment where, like, God helped open up my eyes because I just saw them as, like, a nuisance, and they're going to complain, and they're going to nag, and blah, blah, blah. And my mom didn't say anything. And she's like, I didn't want to come. Like, your dad wanted to come. And so my dad is, like, this big dude, army guy, like, big Puerto Rican army dude. And he was crying. And he was like, how have I failed you as a father? Like, how have I failed you as a dad? He's like, I don't know where I went wrong. And I've only seen him cry one other time, and that was when his grandmother died. And it was like, I saw that. Like, I finally was recognizing what my alcoholism was doing to the people who genuinely cared about me. And I was like, I shut the hell up about onion rings, right? I didn't say a word. I was just like, whatever needs to happen. I was like shaking. I didn't know what to do because in my head, again, delusional thinking, I'm like, but I thought I was doing everything right. Like, I was doing the steps. I was going to meetings. And so I left the ER, and kind of like that time I left that mental institution, I was like, what now? I have no idea what to do. And so I was just calling people. I was calling people, and people were just like, you know, it'll be okay, it'll be okay, it'll be okay. And then finally I called this woman, because that, like, it'll be okay will only last for like 20 minutes, and then you got to get it again, you know? So I called her, and she was like, you don't take this seriously. Like, you're not recognizing that a spiritual solution is the only thing that's going to save you if you want to do the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you haven't really given this a shot. So if I were you, I would get on my knees and genuinely, honestly, sincerely pray and beg God for help. And before bleeding and brain, I would have been like, this woman's crazy. But after, I was like, absolutely. So as soon as I got off the phone, into the prayer, begging God for help, didn't know what to do. I go back to this group, which is now my my home group. It was the first night that I went to my home group was the night that I drank, and I was like a bunch of young, happy, sober people, and I hated all of them. But I was like willing and scared and terrified. I was like, let me go back to that place with the happy God people. And so I went back there, and I found the happiest one, and she would literally walk around and say, "Yay, God!" like, and genuinely meant it. So I was like, will you? And she, like, came up to me because I think I was still kind of like this. I mean, bleeding in the brain and the rib thing, right? So I was like this. And she was like, do you want me to take you through the steps? And I was like, yeah, please. So we did it. And I was like, I did the best that I could in that moment. Like, I was like, I don't really get the God thing. I don't really understand it. But it was cool because the way she explained it to me was like, you don't have to get it. Like, that's the awesome thing. You don't have to get it. Like, whatever is going to kind of work for you, do you think that maybe just kind of sort of there's like this possibility that something bigger than you is going to help you. I was like, that's different than believing that God will save your soul, you know? So I was like, yeah, I'll take that first one. And then I moved forward, and my first experience with the fourth step, I knew this was not a therapy session. So I knew what was coming when I was genuinely like willing to look at this honestly. And then I had, you know, my best attempt at 6 and 7 with a couple months sober. And then I got to amends, and I remember the first time around, I already logged in my head the amends I wasn't going to make. So this time, I was like, I want to do the hardest one first to get it out the way. And I made amends to my old boss, and that was like the most terrifying conversation I had. But I'm so happy that, again, like I was terrified, I was so scared, but I was willing to do it. At one point, like, I called my sponsor. I was like, what do I do? She's like, are you wearing shoes? She's like, I was like, no. She put shoes and leave the house and go meet her. I was like, okay, got it. So I go and I like make this amends. And I remember something where I got up, I walked away, and like the world looked different. Like the colors seemed brighter. There was something about me walking through Center City and I was like, oh my God, these people are not full of shit. Like I was so excited that AA was like, I was having this experience. I was like, this is like nothing that I ever felt before. And it's called like peace of mind, right? So I didn't know what that was, but I was experiencing peace of mind and like freedom in that moment. And I was like, this is amazing. Like there's nothing in my system. Like I just did something I was terrified of doing. I think maybe they're onto something. So I kept making some, you know, I made amends to my parents. Like I was making amends, and then I get to 10, 11, and 12, and I'm like, yes, right? So when I had this experience, like I just could not wait to like sponsor everybody. I was like, you guys, did you know about this, right? So I, you know, I did just that. Like I did my best with 10, 11 at the time, and I was just taking people through, and I was going to meetings, and I was like, you know, I was single, I was young, I didn't have any real responsibilities, so I could do that. I had like a lot of sponsees. So I did that for a little bit. And then what happened was, you know, I made my amends, the local ones that I could, but I wasn't really doing much of anything else besides like sponsoring and like going to a ton of meetings. So like that light and that freedom and that peace of mind that I was feeling, it started to get like dull, right? The light started to go off. And then before, when I was like so excited to talk to sponsees, I'd be like, ugh, she's calling again, you know? Oh, this girl. And then like my home group, like before it was like I would take a commitment, and now I'm like showing up, sitting, Angry Birds. It was the time of Angry Birds. Angry Birds, and then leaving. And I started to think that I was too crazy for AA, right? Because like that excitement, that joy, the enthusiasm left. And now it was just like this obligation. And so at this point, like I had an apartment, right? Like I had a job, like I had a boyfriend, right? But everything sucked. Like my job sucked, my boyfriend sucked, everything sucked. And then I was like causing damage in my relationships with people in AA. Ugh. And so I started to think, I was like, I'm clearly too crazy for AA. Like this momentary flash of goodness expired. And I don't know what I should do. Maybe I should just jump in front of a bus. So, and I remember calling people, and I got some of the weirdest like pieces of advice. Like this one lady told me to eat a banana and take a bath. I was like, what? Right? I was like, there's no amount of bananas that's gonna save this. So when I was getting, and this is like from people in AA, so I was like, she told me to eat a banana and take a bath. I was like, clearly I'm too crazy of like a banana and a bath not gonna save this. And it was like, again, like a very dark period. And I think it was even darker before, because what I was told was the solution, Alcoholics Anonymous, in my head, I thought was no longer the solution. So I was really, really, really unhappy. And then thankfully for God showing up, because he connected me with this woman, because I had a question about something else and then I needed to call her. And I remember I called her for that. I don't even remember what it was. I called her for that, and I was like, okay, cool, this lady seems fine. But I remember being at work. So I worked at a spa at this time, and I needed to, like, log on and do something with an Excel spreadsheet before I could leave. And, like, when you're, like, that, like, jammed up, when you're, like, that, like, untreated, everything is a giant problem. So, like, this Excel spreadsheet would not open up, and I was ready to throw the fucking computer out the window. I was like, I hate it, right? So I'm losing my mind. I'm, like, freaking out. I'm, like, having, like, a panic attack. And for some reason, the thought crosses my mind to call this woman. So I call this lady. And I'm just like, blah, verbal, you know, diarrhea into the phone. We were on the phone for a little bit. And something happened where she recognized what was going on in me. And she started asking me questions about what did my life in AA look like. And I was like, I have a home group, you know. And she's like, well, what are you doing? She's like, what are you doing with like 10 and 11? And I was like, yeah, I've done them. I did them before. And I hadn't, you know, it's like I would read about the 10th step. I would think about meditation, but I'm like, but I'm so like high energy. How can I possibly meditate, right? And then like prayer was a lot of like, you know, it was very haphazard. And so through our conversation, it turned into like this 2-hour-long conversation. And it was, again, one alcoholic talking to another. And I'm so happy that I called her because she was able to like help me see that I wasn't too crazy for AA. I just wasn't doing AA, right? And she was really busy, but I was determined to stalk her until she would sponsor me, and she did. And I remember I drove like to Hamburg, Pennsylvania. I live in Philly, right? I drove to Hamburg, Pennsylvania to do this inventory. And she blew my mind with like helping me to see alcoholism 1.5 years separated from like my last drink. Like, this really is what alcoholism is. And for some reason in my mind, I had the idea that like my main problem was alcohol. I was still running on that old idea. So when I could see like how I was completely powerless, like I was totally powerless, I was like playing God in every area of my life. Like, that actor scenario was 100% me. Like, I had all of these resentments, but they were like kind of under the surface, like the subconscious resentments. And I wasn't aware of it because I wasn't actively practicing a 10 step, you know? And it's like, this is supposed to be a spiritual program of action, a design for living that actually works, but I was paying no attention to God whatsoever. I was like, oh, yeah, cool. But it took like 6 months of pain for me to recognize that, to hear that from this woman. So we did another inventory, another ugly inventory. I had another list of amends. And I would say probably my most like powerful amends that time was when I went to make amends to my parents again. And my dad wasn't having it. He was like, you did this already. It didn't do anything. And I was like, you know, like, okay, I get it. So this grand gesture of like, look at what I'm doing and how sorry I am and I will make this up to you was never followed up with actual action of trying to be like a daughter. Like, I was not actually putting into place any sort of like program of action to show up to be a daughter to them. And like, that clicked. And I was like, okay, cool. And then starting to do a 10 step. And I remember being afraid to ask how to do a 10 step. I would hear about a 4 and 4, but I was like, I don't know, that sounds weird. And so I remember, like, not sure. It was so weird because I was like, when do I do a 10-step? She's like, if you're not sure, just call me. And it became so simple, but I was, again, thank, you know, alcoholic brain, making it so complicated. And with prayer and meditation, it was like little baby steps, at least in meditation. It was like, try 30 seconds, try a minute, try 2 minutes. And then she gave me this tape for, like, 10 minutes. And it was silent meditation, but it was just, like, really quick instructions on how to do it. And I loved how she explained it to me in terms of like spiritual growth. Like, it doesn't say like you're going to grow spiritually and it's going to be the best time of your life, you know? It's like, if growing spiritually is a painful experience because it means that you're growing out of ego, out of selfishness, like all of these things that are just blocking you off. So of course it's not going to be fun because like that ego is so attached to you, you know? But the real you was under there. It just needs spiritual intervention, but you got to put in the work. So I started doing that, and I was recognizing, like, again, I'm all about, like, the tangible, the real, the stuff I can touch. And what I could feel, what I could touch was the fact that, like, I did not hate my life anymore. Amazing. And I, like, how like, a simple 10-step literally transformed, like, my relationships with people. So, for example, work stuff. I had a job, and my boss said that I needed an assistant manager. And I was like, okay, cool. So we brought in this girl, we interviewed her, and I was like, she's really great, let's hire her. We brought her on, and then my alcoholic brain got really resentful at her because she was too good, you know what I mean? She was like really, really good, and she was going to take my job, and everybody was going to see how great she was. So before Life of 10 Step, I would have just like lived in that, you know, just like, she's so good, and I would have caused problems with her, and I would have caused problems with my new boss, and the customers would have felt the effects, like all of this stuff, but like, having a conversation with like resentment and, you know, how are you being selfish, self-centered, dishonest, afraid? How are you being all of those things? Being very descriptive with that. Now, how would God have you be removing that fear? And then be that, like ask God for the power to be that. It was like, okay, so be trusting of God, be accepting of her, be open to what she has to teach me. And like, it transformed our relationship. Like, she's literally one of like my best friends. This is years ago. And she, like, I went to her wedding in Maryland, and she lives in Indiana, and she's going to come see me, and she's going to have a baby, and it's so cool. And then another work environment, I got this job, and like, it was like my first corporate job, and I was so nervous and so scared because my head is saying, you don't belong here, they're better than you, look at how non-alcoholic they are. And and I was so nervous and so scared, and there was this woman that hated me so much, she was so mean to me, like, she literally flicked me off. And I was like, how am I supposed to handle that? And my sponsor was like, patience, pity, tolerance, put yourself in her shoes, like try to be understanding. And this is not my natural way. And it was like, I didn't want to do it, but I also still had that willingness to like put these principles into action. And again, she became one of like my best friends. And like I left that company and then she found out about this new job and she got me the job that I have now. I'm back working with her because of like principles. And like I literally got promoted because people were like, we like your behavior. People enjoy being around you. And I'm like, that's not natural. I do this because I'm going to die. Like, cool though, you know? So it's like I started to see like these real actual results when I'm really doing this stuff, you know? And then, you know, my relationship with my parents completely transformed. So after that, like, I want to say shitty eighth step, but it was actually great because it helped me to see, like, it helped me to really see, like, this is the daily, daily thing. Like, I actually have to do this. I didn't talk to my parents for like a year. And now, like, we talk to each other all of the time. Like, I talk to my parents all of the time. And they're down in Philadelphia. Like, we see each other, like, at least once a month. And they're so amazed by like my friends in AA. They're like, every time they come down, they're like, your friends are amazing. Like you have the best relationships. Like they're just blown away by how big and beautiful and wonderful AA is. And what it's done for me as a person. And also like the people that I've attracted in my life, because we're all genuinely trying to like live by spiritual principles and be better people. Amazing. And, so what it's like now, right? I don't know, like 5 years ago or something like that, I like met this guy and I remember being so nervous because like I was working with my sponsor and I was like, just, you know, I was trying to date. I was like, I'm going to date normally. I don't even know what that means, but I'm going to do it. And, I'm going to date. And I remember like asking God to help me be genuine and authentic and all of these things. And like, you know, and to recognize him and to be all of these things that I just wasn't naturally like that at all. And so we're together, and I get pregnant. And I remember I was like, we weren't very far along in our relationship. I was like, what does this mean? Is he gonna be happy? And I remember when I went to tell him that that I was gonna have a baby, we were gonna get a one-bedroom apartment together, and he's like, well, I guess we're getting a two-bedroom apartment. And that was like the most amazing thing anybody could have said to me. So what life like is now is the fact that, so I have a 3-year-old son. I have a 1.5-year-old daughter. Me and that guy were married. We sold a house. We bought a house. He lost his job. My 3-year-old was diagnosed with autism last year. And so, like, my life now looks very different than my life did before children and before husband, because the way that I was doing, like everything, like, I was very active in AA. Like, I was, like, at meetings all the time. I was, like, doing road trips all the time. I was doing all this stuff because I had, like, the flexibility to do that. And now I don't. And I remember that was like a huge, 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 that was really, really difficult for me to try to figure out how can I still live this way of life when I'm used to doing it this way. Like AA gave me this life. Like I devote pretty much all of my life outside of work to this, but now I have these responsibilities like wifehood and like motherhood, you know? And I don't know what that means. And that's really scary. And that caused a lot, that caused trouble with like my marriage. Like I would love to be like, I got married and everything's perfect, the end. But that's totally not it. Like he's not an alcoholic. He doesn't really get alcoholism, but he gets that when I come back from these things, I'm real happy. But I had to like find another way this design for living had to be shifted in a totally different way. Like it was way more of a dependence on God. And I didn't realize like how much I was depending on like, I guess like the fellowship. I don't know, but like I can't do the same things that I used to do before. So there has to. I cannot be flexible when it comes to prayer and meditation. Otherwise I'm a real bitch, you guys. And I'm a bad mom. Like I'm mean to my kids and I'm not accepting and loving of them when they are toddlers, and toddlers are not real people. Like they're little monsters. So it's so hard. But then like I'm recognizing how like the more I do this, like how big God is, like how big and how important like God works in every area of my life. And the area that I struggle the most now is with my son's autism. And I don't want to cry, but sometimes it makes me cry. So when I got pregnant, I decided that my sponsor didn't understand me. Eye roll. So she didn't understand me because she wasn't a mom. So then I got a new sponsor who was telling me the exact same stuff that my old sponsor was, but I just needed that. And then this new sponsor, you know, she helped me along the way. My son was born. I'm totally rambling, you guys, sorry. So my son was born, and I knew there was something was off with him, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And she happened to own this early intervention agency, and she's like, follow these steps. So I get him, he wasn't speaking, so I get him involved in early intervention. And we didn't do any sort of interaction, but his main person, like his main therapist, was the program director of the company that my sponsor owned. Weird, right? So it was like just total connection there. And then she gave me all the instructions. She's like, okay, to get an autism diagnosis, you got to do all this other stuff. And I did all the other stuff. And he needed extra therapies, right? So then I reached out to this girl who me and her used to be young and sober together. Like she was living in a recovery house. We would just smoke so many cigarettes and drink Red Bulls all day. And she's like, yeah, I'm actually an ABA therapist, which is for autism. And she became my son's main therapist. And after 2 months of working with her, my son started talking in like 2 months. And it was like this tiny little thing, but he understood the concept of saying the word more. And he could not get that. We tried that with him for a year, but 2 months working with her, it was with toothpaste because it's strawberry, so it's delicious. So he was asking for like more. She gave me everything that I needed for getting him into the school that he's in. And I say that I struggle the most with this because I feel like before kids and before whatever, I sort of had this idea that like, if life doesn't go my way, I can just quit it and do whatever I want, I guess. But like, I don't get to do that now because I have like these little people, and I'm having a hard time comprehending the fact that I am not in charge of my son's life. Like, God is his true parent, right? I am sort of like this like earth custodian to help him along the way, but I'm not the true parent. And I'm saying this out loud as a reminder to myself because this is constantly on my inventory because I'm so full of fear with what his future is going to look like. And every time that I accept that he is taken care of and that I really am just here to put in the footwork, he's going to be okay and it's going to turn out exactly the way it's supposed to. And I have enough experience being here for 8 years to know that that will not fail. And it doesn't matter if there's children involved or my husband or whatever. And so we had like this meeting for his school. And I love how like my delusional alcoholic head made them the enemy, right? So we had this meeting because I'm like, he actually needs more services because of blah, 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 blah. And they said no, and they wanted to meet with us and to review it, to look at this as potentially what we could do to change it. And in my brain, I decided that they were the enemy, and I was like, I'm going to get a lawyer, and we're going to do this and this and this. And I got so crazy and so stressed out, and I made my husband's life miserable, and I was kind of mean at work and all of this stuff. And then I recognized, like, hey, it's still the same stuff. Like, it's still the same turning it over. It's still the same asking God for help. Like, there is no difference here, even though this is a current experience. You still do the same stuff. And I remember begging God to help me to accept what was in front of me and to help just be the bright spot in whatever area of my life that I'm in. So whether it's at work or dealing with his school administration, and I've made in my head that they were enemy, to do that. And just there's something about, like, I don't know, maybe the experience or the constant prayer or like the inventory. We went into that meeting and I was like ready to fight them, like to physically fight them. And then something happened where like my like energy shifted, and by the end of it we were like hugging. It was the weirdest thing. But I know that the only way, like I would be like the hassle parent, and I would make my son's life miserable because of my alcoholism, because I can get that delusional. But like if I constantly invite all of like the God into my life and the principles and all of this stuff, then we can't fail. Like we, like me, kids, husband, we're gonna be okay. So I ramble. So there's like 5 minutes left, but I think I'm done. So I just wanna say that if you're new, and you think this stuff is really weird and stupid, that's okay, because I don't know anybody who walked in and said, this is definitely gonna work. So just try it. Just try it, because like life drinking will always be there for you. Like you can, liquor stores will always be there for you. But try this and see how it goes. So that's all. Thanks.